Hi, and welcome to The Horn, a podcast from the International Crisis Group. I'm Alan Boswell. Today, my colleague Enrica Pico is joining us on the show. Enrica is our Central Africa director, and she's here to speak with us about the situation in Chad, where a young new ruler is tightening his grip even as elections are scheduled for May. Enrica, thanks for coming on the show. We have a lot to get into.
Thank you, Alan.
So some listeners may know that we've actually never done an episode on Chad. So this episode will serve a bit as a deep explainer, also hopefully, on the country's politics. Now, elections are set for May. That's in essentially a few weeks. The transitional president, Mahamat Idriss Deby, seems to have killed off his main opposition challenger. Other opposition leaders are banned from running. I don't think it's being much of a spoiler to say that the elections themselves don't look like much of a nail biter. But before we get into all of that, Enrica, can you just remind our listeners how Deby came to power after his father passed away and what system he inherited from him?
Yeah, it was April 2021 when his father, Idriss Deby Itno, was killed on the battlefield when a Libya-based armed group, the FACT, launched an offensive to take the capital of Chad, N'Djamena. President Idriss Deby was on the battlefield to support the troops and he was killed there. And in 48 hours, a group of generals who were very close to the late president named one of his sons, Mahamat Deby, as transitional president, supported by this group of generals that they called themselves Transitional Military Council. There were protests in the streets of N'Djamena, the capital, and in other towns all around the country. They were repressed by the security forces for a few days. But then after that, the message that the transitional president Mahamat Deby passed was a message of opening to opposition and armed groups. So this came down, at least at the beginning, the protest. The African Union at that time treated Chad as an exception, did not suspend Chad from the regional organization because of his role in the fight against terrorism in the Sahel, but put two conditions for the transition to succeed and also not to treat this unconstitutional change of power as a coup. The first condition was the duration of the transition, 18 months only, and then after that, power will need to return to civilians. And the second condition, even more important today, is that the member of the transition, including the generals taking power after the death of Idriss Deby, will not run for election at the end of the transition. So it's clear that Chadians found themselves, after 1 or 2 months after the death of Idriss Deby, kind of trapped in a dynastic succession. But at that time, there was still hope that something could change, that the new president could change some of the rules. And what were the rules at the time? Well, it was 30 years of a regime that made very little concession to the opposition, that basically co-opted most of the opposition members along the process, and that founded his power on a tribal basis, in the sense that for 30 years, Idriss Deby, who was from the Zagawa clan, ruled the country with only two other ethnic groups, both from the north of the country, the Goran and the Arabs. The governance system was extremely based on a tribalistic conception of power, I will say, and was conceding very little to other ethnic groups, but also different voices in the country.
Is it safe to say that expectations for Idriss Deby's son, Mahamat, were rather low when he took power? I seem to remember him being, you know, in some ways not taken very seriously at the time.
It was not mainly because of his age. He was 37 when he took power, and also because he was never involved in politics. But among the other sons of Idriss Deby was the one with a more clean background. He was not involved in scandals or any other maneuver of the regime. So he was basically the only clean face that the regime could put on stage at that time. The fact that he was so young, it was surely something that did not help to take him seriously from many observers, but it was also something that made many Chadians have some hope, because since the beginning he proposed himself as the representative of a new generation of Chadians. And at the beginning, his words were followed by actions, because he did open dialogue and negotiation with opposition parties like the Transformateur, led by Success Masra, like Wakitama, a platform of civil society organizations, and also with the rebel groups in country and outside of the country. So there was a kind of opening at the beginning that let Chadians hope that some kind of change with the previous regime was possible. But that did not last long. It was mainly 2021, the first few months on the transition, and then things started to go back to the previous track.
And then militarily, what happened to the FACT rebels, the FACT insurgents who killed Idriss Deby?
After the offensive launched by the FACT in April 2021 was pushed back by Chadian forces with the support of French aerial means, they went back to Libya, where they were based. At the time, they still had substantive military power in Libya, but no further action was taken by the Chadian military forces to go into Libya and to basically finish the work they started. This happened 2 years later, actually, because in August last year, in August 23, with an agreement with Libyan Marshal Haftar, President Deby basically organized a military operation from Chad against the bases of FACT in Libya, in the same time that Marshal Haftar forces were bombing the FACT camps in the south of Libya. So we can basically say that today the threat that FACT represented at that time doesn't exist anymore.
Interesting. So obviously the French were very close to Mahamat Idriss Deby's father, Idriss Deby, who was in charge and ruled Chad for a very long time. How was Mahamat received by the French when he came to power in this obviously very unplanned transfer of power?
You know, Alan, there is a picture taken at the funeral of Idriss Deby that is almost self-explanatory and that is in the mind of all the Chadians since that day. It's the picture of President Macron and Mahamat Deby sitting together and smiling. I mean, the support from France and the back from France of Idriss Deby was something well known and relatively accepted. But this picture, basically, it was almost a sign for many Chadians that France installed Mahamat Deby as president in the place of his father. And this was something that provoked immediate reaction in Chad and that fueled anti-French sentiment in the capital, in N'Djamena, but all across the country. And only 1 year after the transition, the first anti-French protests were held in N'Djamena in May 22. And they were very violent, and they were the first sign that there were other voices also to be listened to in the country, without counting the fact that in the same year, 21-22, many other countries in the Sahel, Burkina Faso, Mali, and early sign in Niger, that were raising their voices against the French. So the French support is still there and has been reaffirmed recently, but I will say that has never been so challenged and contested in Chad.
Okay. So then moving ahead a bit further, closer to the present day, what happened in the first few years? What happened after Mahamat came to power? There's a very large, fragmented opposition, which obviously had been operating under very repressive conditions for a long time. There was this initiative by the Qataris to try to forge some broader political settlement, but that seemed to lose steam pretty quickly. So what happened right after he came to power in the political scene?
In a nutshell, the objective of the transition of President Deby was to organize a national dialogue. For this reason, was holding a negotiation with the main platform of political opposition and civil society, mainly at that time a party called Les Transformateurs of Success Masra and a civil society platform called Wakitama, among many others, because as you said, the position in Chad has always been very fragmented. And in the meantime, time was also negotiating with armed groups, with rebel groups, a way for their participation to the national dialogue. This is where the Qatari came in. Doha proposed to facilitate a dialogue between the government, the transitional government, and the Chadian rebel groups. And negotiations were ongoing in Doha for 5 months, from March 22 to August 22. Those negotiations obviously were charged of hope at the beginning, but after a few months, the usual issues came out in terms of who was really representing a threat for the transitional government, who were the armed groups who really had military power and were able, as I said, to threat the transition, and who were not, because there were more than 40 armed groups represented in Doha. At the end, an agreement was signed in August 2022 for their participation to the national dialogue, including the condition of the disarmament, the condition of the return of rebel leaders to the country. But the fact, as I mentioned earlier, the group was responsible, actually, of the beginning of the transition, did not sign this agreement and boycotted the national dialogue. In the meantime, in Chad, Les Transformateurs, Wakit Tamah, and other opposition parties were asking President Déby to guarantee that he will not run for election as a condition for the participation to the national dialogue. President Déby never said explicitly that, never said the opposite either, but never stated that he will not run for election at the end of the transition. So when the national dialogue started in August 2022, the most vocal opposition leaders did not join the discussions. And after a few weeks, also the church withdrew from the dialogue, because they say that the condition for inclusivity and representativity were not there. The dialogue took place anyway at the beginning of October 22. The recommendation of the dialogue, among the usual wish list in terms of governance, development, accountability, etc., the main recommendation actually allowed leaders of the transition to run for election. And at that time, was clear that Mehmet Déby will run at the end of the transition. This provoked a wave of frustration and rage and discontent all across the country, and made the opposition call for continuous protests and manifestations. On the 20th of October 22, a big protest began in N'Djamena. The protesters were targeting administrative building and the HQ of some party close to the government. After a few hours, the crackdown of the security forces against the protesters started. And after 1 day of unrest, there were more than 200 people killed, more than 500 wounded, and 1,000 arrested. And this day marked the transition, marked a U-turn in the transition, because that was the end of the hope that I mentioned at the beginning, the hope that many Chadians had that something could change. And after that, repression followed. Most of the opposition leaders were reduced to silence or were forced to leave the country, and some of them still live in exile. And on the other side, cooptation of the other opposition or civil society organization followed. President Déby basically bought off most of the leaders that were joining those two big opposition coalition at the beginning of the transition, as well as some of the rebel leaders who did not sign the Doha agreement the previous year. And this calmed things down, because people people were in shock for many months, and in the same time allowed Déby to organize the rest of the transition. So basically to respect formally the calendar of the transition with constitutional referendum, elections, etc. The other milestone of the transition were basically an empty shell, because inclusivity was not guaranteed, because the ruling party and people close to the Déby clan were basically taking the main decision to bring the transition forward.
This all sounds a bit like a transition without a transition, so to speak. About a year ago, amid all of these politics in Chad itself. You had Sudan collapse into civil war. This is an extremely dangerous situation for Chad, given the very porous border between Sudan and Chad, between Darfur and Chad, and the amount of crossover that has been there historically. How did President Deby respond to that war in neighboring Sudan?
In April 2023, when the conflict started, the first reaction of President Deby was to close the border with Sudan, except for refugees, and to take a neutral stance toward the conflict. Only a few months earlier, in January, February 2023, both Al-Burhan, General Al-Burhan and MAT visited N'Djamena separately in two different trips. And they both probably tried to get some support from Deby. The closure of the border was followed by the deployment of security forces all along the borders, but mainly around the main entry point from West Darfur and North Darfur. This did not, as I said, did not prevent refugees to come in. So after the first fight in West Darfur, in Janina, dozens of thousands of people came into Chad and they were hosted in the Wadai region in the east of Chad, that actually already hosted at the time more than 400,000 Sudanese who had fled from the 2003-2005 conflict in Darfur. The neutral stance asserted by Deby at the beginning of the conflict lasted only till only a few months. In summer 2023, there were already rumors of support coming from Chad to the RSF, to the Rapid Response Forces of MAT in Sudan, and sponsored by the Emiratis. The Emiratis built an hospital in Amjaras, in a location in the northeast of Chad, relatively close to the Sudanese border, for humanitarian purposes in July 2023. And after a few weeks, military support start moving from there to Darfur, to the RSF militias in Darfur. And in the same time, in July, Deby traveled to Abu Dhabi and signed a military cooperation agreement with the Emiratis, which included the delivery of weapons and military equipment to Chad. But obviously, this agreement was not only related to Darfur, but also represented an important financial support for the Chadian regime. And many observers say that the gold mines in the north of Chad, along the border with Libya, were also included in this deal. This had some consequences in terms of diplomatic relations with Sudan. And in December, January last year, the Sudanese ambassador was expelled from Chad and the Chadian ambassador from Khartoum. So for the moment, where Chad stands? The neutral stance is not there anymore, clearly. Chad, as mentioned, after the clashes in West Darfur, received hundreds of thousands of refugees, mainly Masalit, fleeing from the violence in Darfur, and including also Masalit fighters who fought against the RSF in Darfur. There have been rumors as well that Masalit are regrouping in Chad and try to launch a counteroffensive in Darfur. For the moment, they don't have the means to return there and to fight against the Arabs militias, but they are still in Chad. The position of the Deby in all this is prioritizing the stability of the country. So it does not allow armed groups or fighters to take Chad as a rear base to launch attacks in Sudan. And this is where we are. This is where we are now.
Now, when the war broke out, I think most observers, including us, thought that essentially Chad would have no choice but to take a neutral position, because it was sort of damned if you do and damned if you don't. If RSF, was militarily victorious or militarily powerful, it could have major blowbacks on Chad itself, given the amount of Chadian Arabs rumored to be joining RSF, and Hemeti's own ties ancestrally to Chad as well. And then meanwhile, to oppose the RSF also seemed risky for almost the same reasons. But then, as you mentioned, there was this heavy support, in a sense, or at least allowing heavy support to flow through Chad to the RSF. surely this angered many of the Zagawa in Debbie's own tribe, own clan, own ethnic group, given that in Darfur itself, most Zagawa consider RSF to be their enemy. So how has Debbie sort of managed that? Because many of us thought that he would be inviting far too much internal opposition if he ever allowed there to be any support to RSF.
Well, there were, as you said, Alan, some protests organized in Amjaras. There were some protests also going on social media against the support to the RSF. And as you mentioned, also something important to remind is that most of the RSF associated militia on the other side of the border are Chadians, Arab Chadians who joined the conflict in Darfur in early 2000 and then were integrated into the militia. And so this is, as you say, the ties with Chad are very close. So the protests were never very visible, but they were ongoing. And this was the support to the RSF in the past year was not the only thing that angered the Zagawa clan. Debbie forced to retirement more than 200 generals, mainly Zagawa, not only, but mainly Zagawa, and mainly people close to his father. He replaced them with younger officials loyal to him and, most importantly, not only from the Zagawa clan, but also including mainly Goran, the clan of his mother, but also Arabs. So this, together with the support to the RSF, is definitely something that creates frustrations among the clan. The regime managed to handle them in the same way he managed to handle civil and military opposition, basically buying off more of this discontent among his own clan. This showed that in terms of the financial situation for the regime for the moment is relatively good shape, but also create greater risk because these compensations and this the situation and the discontent risk of growing. And there were many rumors of a palace coup that could have been organized against Debbie from his very same clan.
Okay, so zooming us up to the present day or close to the present day, as mentioned, we have elections and basically just a few weeks in early May. And just a few weeks ago, there was this apparent assassination of the main opposition leader, who also happened to be Debbie's cousin, I believe. What do we know about exactly what happened?
Yaya Diallo, the opposition leader killed at the end of February, was Debbie's cousin from the same Sou clan of the Debbie family, the rest of the Debbie family, and was an opponent to Idriss Debbie first and Mahamat Debbie, then regime since 2005. In 2005, basically broke his relations with Idriss Debbie, joined the rebellion, and after a few months was reintegrated in the government as a minister. And since that, he alternated position in the rebellion, in the government, and as a president of the Socialist Party Without Borders in Chad. He was very outspoken. He attacked Mahamat Debbie in several occasions since the beginning of the transition. And for many people, even belonging to the clan, he went too far. But nobody could expect what happened at the end of February, as I said. In a couple of days, Yaya Diallo and other supporters of the Socialist Party Without Borders were killed, and the HQ of the party was completely destroyed by bulldozers sent by the government. There are contradictory versions from the government and from the opposition about the death of Yaya Diallo, but the most credible reconstruction, there was an arrest of another member of the Socialist Party on the 27th of February. This arrest provoked the angry reaction of party supporters and the family of this political opponent, and there was a crowd going to the HQ of the National Foreign Intelligence in N'Djamena. People opened fire against the crowd, and after that, eight people were killed and several others were wounded. The day after, N'Djamena was basically in state of emergency. Nobody could move around. And the security forces launched a military operation against the party headquarters. And according to the government, during this shootout, Yahya Diallo was killed. But the opposition started circulating the picture of Yahya Diallo's body, and there was a clear sign that Yahya Diallo was basically killed, was shot at point blank range, which made the opposition to call it a targeted assassination. N'Djamena went back to normal in less than 24 hours, and only 2 days after the event, without even mentioning what happened during the event, Mahamat Debi announced that he will run for election. While the only reaction to the events was left to Prime Minister Success Masra, who announced an independent investigation, an international type of independent investigation to this. So at the end, it was, I would say, an utter shock after the one on 20 October 22 that showed to Chad how far President Deby will go to securize his regime. The death of Yahya Diallo did not raise any statement or any reaction from both the regional and the international community. There were no statement issued from the African Union, nor from France or the US, or most of the traditional international partners of Chad. This is something that which unveiled the fact that Chad has become the last stronghold of stability in the Sahel, and more importantly, the last stronghold of Western countries in the Sahel. So nobody is basically taking a chance of condemning political repression.
Right. So, but before we move on to the elections next month, what does it say about Chadian politics that this primary rival of his was also a cousin and a member of the Zagawa subclan, the same one as Deby? And the Zagawa, I think, are only some 2% of Chad's population overall.
This is absolutely not new in Chadian politics. Is the death of Yahya Diallo reminded to many Chadians the method used by Idriss Deby, especially in the 90s. In the 90s, there was some opening, more or less similar to what we watched at the beginning of the transition, some opening in terms of civil society and opposition. But after that, Idriss Deby tied again his regime and start targeting some of the opposition in Chad and in exile. So cooptation, repression and violence are, I would say, the main characteristic of politics in Chad. There was a strategy from President, from Idriss Deby, to place most of the Zagawa, most of the people coming from his clan, to keep position in both administration, civilian administration, and military. And this is something that has been maintained by his son. Though, as I said, Mahamat Deby is trying to differentiate a bit, to open the tribal base of his power to Goran and Arabs.
So Deby seems to have shown himself both determined to stay in power and quite audacious in what he's willing to do to stay in power. So what do we expect with elections that are coming up in early May?
Only 10 presidential candidates have been admitted. Recently, the Constitutional Council rejected the application of more than 10 candidates on some legal basis, but that was another way of excluding potential adversaries from the northern regions. For the moment, the result of the election is pretty predictable. There are no political adversaries of the same political weight, of the same weight of the B. After election, we can expect that the tandem that is already ongoing between Deby and Masra, the current prime minister, will continue in a way or another under the flag of a national reconciliation between the two main opponents from the beginning of the transition. But in reality, it will not be more than a limited share of power that Deby will allow to basically calm down the protests and the concern of his allies, mainly Western allies. After that, the regime will probably I mean, he's preparing his way to power for a long time, it seems. But he's also need to be careful about a few issues that can destabilize the regime. The first one, as we mentioned, is the balance of power within the ruling clan, within the Zagawa clan itself, but also with the Goran and the Arabs. And this balance of power has never been so fragile. So the reactions after the death of Yahya Lillo were, the reaction was very little, but this not means that people will forget what happened in February this year. And on the other end, as I say, the support to the RSF in Sudan is also generating frustration among clan. On the other side, and this will also be a challenge for Deby, Chad can be at the center of the struggle for influence in the region between the Western and the Eastern bloc. Since the beginning of the transition, Deby diversified his security partners, keeping the support from France, but also signing military deals with Turkey, with Emirates, the Saudis as well, and possibly with Russia. At the end of January, Deby traveled to Moscow to meet President Putin, and the outcome of the agreement remained confidential. It was a clear sign to Paris that Chad is not anymore France's preferred partner in the region, but that is a sovereign country that can basically knock too many doors in the same time. So this was an alert from France, but it was also something that Deby could use internally, because a trip to Moscow could help him low the anti-French sentiment in the country, showing that his link with the French are only a link of interest, but he's also going to see other partners. But can be also a risk, because pressure from the other Sahel states to join the alliance of Sahelian states could grow. And I mean, the advantages that the B is now taking from keeping all the doors open to both the Western and the Eastern bloc might become a threat to the stability of the country in the coming years.
So I'll go ahead and close us out here with one final question. I mean, this sounds like a story of survival, and then after survival, in some ways, a story now of consolidation. At times, it sounds like he's been reckless, but increasingly, it almost sounds like he's been quite wily, both internally and externally, ruthlessly internally, and now taking the opportunity of a very divided world order to also flirt with many different powers and play them off of each other externally. So, you know, his father ruled for a very long time, obviously, and he's clearly setting himself up to try to rule for a very long time as well. How long can a system like this last in Chad? And really, what's the biggest risk to it not lasting?
Well, the experience, the regime of his father showed that this kind of system can last for a very long time, also because is basing itself on a patronage system that is very consolidated, is very well consolidated in Chad. But this not means that the regime will be spared from both internal and external threats. In terms of internal threats, I will say that the main one that we can see today is the socioeconomic situation of the Chadian youth and in general of the Chadian population. It's difficult to see how this will evolve, because obviously there can be a protest in the capital, there can be another wave of strike and arrest, but there is no leader that can lead this, that can take this movement and bring it to something else. But the frustrations against the regime for not doing enough to improve the condition, the living condition of the Chadians are really growing very fast, in the capital mainly, but all around the country. The other threat, also internal, is linked to intercommunal violence. Only a couple of weeks ago, in only 3 days of clashes between two communities in the east of Chad, 45 people were killed. And it's not unusual. The way the transition has been managed, again, the patronage system put in place by the Bee family is increasing the violence, is acting as a catalyzer to increase violence and increase the cycle of reprisal and retaliation. So, in terms of external threats, as I mentioned, I think one of the main risks for the stability, it will not come for the moment from armed groups, because the agreement reached by the Bee, Libya, with the Central African Republic as well, will for the moment prevent that armed groups could use as rear base the two neighbor country to launch an attack or to destabilize N'Djamena. On the Eastern Front, things are a bit more unclear for the moment. It will mostly depend on the development of the Sudanese conflict and on the control of the RSF and the MET of Darfur and the area along the Chadian border. There is always a risk, because that's has been the place from which most of the Darfur has been the place from which most of the Chadian rebellions have launched attacks on N'Djamena. But for the moment, it's too early to see how this could take form, and this could be shaped in the coming months or years. Another external threat can come, as I said, from the struggle for influence in the Sahel. We have seen after the trip of the Bee to Moscow an increase the Russian propaganda machine start working in Chad as well, calling for the Bee to go even further and to join the alliance of the Sahelian states composed by Mali, Burkina Faso, and Niger. The Bee has a very close relation with many people that are now part of the junta, of the military junta in Niger, because they all fought together against the jihadist insurgents in the Sahel. So this can also another factor of pressure on his regime. And the other side, obviously, France and the US are still putting all the resources to keep Chad on the western side, as is the only remaining country that did not turn back to the westerns in the entire region. So that's for the moment has been used in a kind of smart way from the Bee for both internal and external purposes, but it can turn into a threat to the stability of the country if pressures and instrumentalization also of the anti-French sentiment in the country increase.
Thanks, Enrica, for coming on and for for explaining in such great detail what exactly is going on in Chad.
Thank you, Alan, for having me.
Thanks for listening. Enrica is also the host of a new crisis group podcast, Afrique 360, which is in French. For you Anglophones, The Horn is a production of the International Crisis Group. I'm Alan Boswell, and our producers are Mae Francis and Ida Holly-Nabi.